Welcome to Silicon Bites episode 41. And amidst all the doom and gloom of the lack of weapon supplies to Ukraine, especially from the US, and also reports that Russia is making huge gains on the front, we'll question actually how huge those gains actually are. Amid all of this negative talk about Ukraine, I also want to focus in this episode on the advantages that Ukraine has. And one of those advantages is huge. It is potential of Ukrainian forces to conduct long-range drone strikes against Russian oil refineries and potentially other fuel-related facilities. We're going to look at some of the deeper analysis and reporting around this topic, starting with foreign policy. Ukraine takes the war to Russia's oil refineries. Kyiv aims to do with explosives what 2 years of Western sanctions haven't yet managed, says Foreign Policy on March the 27th. Report states in recent weeks, Ukraine has found a way to overcome a lack of aid and the dearth of ammunition by using long-range drones to strike oil industry assets deep inside Russia. The attacks on Russian oil refineries, and now we have seen more than a dozen of them, include some very long-range strikes, and these have the ability to seriously damage Russia's ability to process and refine its huge output of crude oil. That has dealt so far a relatively small blow, but a meaningful blow to the Russian energy sector that so far has got through the apparently intense Western sanctions, and remained in surprisingly good shape. Well, we're going to look at some of the reasons why that is, including the creation of Russia's Grey Fleet. And why is this important? Well, the Kremlin gets around 40% of its federal budget from the export of crude oil and refined products. And of course, Russia's war machine is very much dependent on those refined oil products. This, therefore, is a key sector in the Russian economy and a key part that enables the Kremlin to increase defense spending, which it is massively doing overall and as a proportion of its overall budget. It allows the Kremlin to rebuild its armies. And in fact, recent reports show that it has almost entirely used up the original army that it had when it invaded Ukraine. And the size and the scale of the army that it currently has is almost entirely dependent on people who are recruited since the launch of Putin's so-called special military operation. This oil purchasing allows Russia to bring in huge amounts of foreign-made weapons and, crucially, Western components to carry on building missiles and, we now believe, manufacture drones based on the Iranian Shahed model in Russia itself, probably assembling the parts rather than building any of those components from scratch. Russian refineries also churn out millions of barrels a day of products crucial to Russia's war effort. This includes diesel and aviation fuel, which is required to keep Russia's death machine in the air and moving forward on the ground. Ukrainian strikes so far have damaged numerous refineries and started many fires at those facilities as well. This is estimated to have knocked out between 400 and 900,000 barrels a day of refining capacity, according to estimates from energy experts and defense officials. Now, we cannot know how many of those plants are fully or permanently out of action, or what capacity Russia has to do repairs, or indeed whether there is refining capacity even in those facilities that were hit to carry on working. So while the impact of the Ukrainian strikes has varied from refinery to refinery, it does, however, present some major issues for Moscow. First, the continued attacks will further stretch Russia's limited air defenses, and that is across far further and further flung parts of the Russian territory, a vast sprawling territory which is practically impossible to defend. And as we've said in the previous Silicon Bites, there are potentially thousands of facilities that Ukraine could hit that play a role within Russia's war machine. Facilities churning out missiles, bombs, glide bombs, refurbishing tanks, and so on. Secondly, due to the Western sanctions, and this is one bit which actually does seem to be working, repairs to the advanced refineries are much, much more difficult because many of the components required to service, repair, or upgrade the refineries are becoming far more difficult and far more expensive for Russia to import. Now, the Kremlin has claimed that its strikes against Ukrainian energy facilities are retaliation. That is clearly a bogus claim because when it could strike energy facilities last year, Russia did so. It's only the inability to get through Ukrainian air defense over the last 12 months or so that has meant that it wasn't hitting Ukrainian energy infrastructure as hard as it would have liked to. Now, of course, with the current impasse in the American political system, it does seem that Ukraine is running short on munitions for systems like Hawk and Patriot in order to protect the skies around Kyiv, Kharkiv, and other major urban centers. And this is the reason why Moscow has been able to get its missiles through to destroy big swathes of Ukrainian energy infrastructure when previously it couldn't. The idea of Moscow holding back is one that a lot of propagandists repeat over and over. But if you look at the facts on the ground, it is plainly ludicrous. The terror and destruction that Russia inflicts upon Ukraine is directly related to its capacity to inflict that, not its willingness. That is almost unlimited. But these strikes on energy facilities do seem to be rippling through the trading rooms in New York and London. Global oil prices have stayed above $80 a barrel and seem to be rising in the last couple of days. That, of course, is fueling concerns that the escalation of Ukrainian attacks could inflict further damage on one of the world's biggest oil producers and exporters. But at the same time, a spike in prices could also benefit Russia, and it could deal a blow to Biden in the forthcoming US election. Supporters of Biden and the Biden administration itself, who are facing that election in the autumn, do seem extremely nervous about the Ukrainian drone campaign. US officials have reportedly asked Ukraine to limit the strikes on Russian oil facilities that could lead to higher prices. Kyiv has made it clear that the campaign will continue. In that, I think they are absolutely correct to say this. They have found a lever. They have found a strategy that genuinely hurts Russia's ability to fund its war. It genuinely hurts Russia's ability to grease the wheels of that war with the fuel oils that it needs. It also makes Putin and his gang of thugs look incredibly weak, especially, and we'll come to this in a minute, especially in a week where floods are devastating parts of Russia, and it is quite clear there is neither the will nor the intent nor the resources to deal with the outcome of those floods because the Kremlin is purely focused on executing its genocidal war in Ukraine. And we reported on this during the week, but it bears repetition because I think it is a disgraceful comment. A White House National Security spokesperson, John Kirby, reiterated that we do not encourage or enable the Ukrainian military to conduct strikes inside Russia. Since the start of the war, the Biden administration has been really wary of squeezing Russia's energy golden goose too hard, says foreign policy, lest it has a knock-on effect on global energy prices. The embargo of Russian oil exports was only gradually phased in, and a price cap on Russian crude oil meant to limit Moscow's energy earnings has proved to be disappointing and largely ineffective. Well, we're going to look at some of the reasons for that in a second. And building on that report, here is an article by Sky News pointing out that the price of Brent crude has climbed above $89 per barrel following the strikes on Russian oil facilities by Ukraine. And whereas the concerns are certainly understandable, asking a country that is under genocidal assault by a fascistic regime such as Russia, asking them to die quietly for the sake of a smooth election or to keep oil prices low is disingenuous and, quite frankly, disgusting. And many of the commentators over the weekend are fervently hopeful that Ukraine will ignore these kind of requests coming out of Washington and other capitals because it has found a way to get Russia over a barrel, as it were, and to an extent make up for the deficit of munitions and capability on the front lines. Now, it's my strong belief that Ukraine will gain many of the munitions it needs over the coming weeks and months. It's always slow. It's always after the time when those are most needed. And of course, it is always after Ukraine has sustained extraordinary losses, terrible losses of its troops, which it may not have had to do if it was properly equipped and supplied in good time. But it is what it is. But some publications this weekend are going even further and saying that the concern in Washington and other capitals about oil prices is not just to do with the escalating price increase and the knock-on it may have in electoral processes. There are claims that actually big oil companies are the real force behind the US criticism of Ukrainian strikes on Russian refineries. Well, you'll know from the previous Silicon Bites that escalation management is very much a feature of the US policy. So clearly, that desire not to upset Russia, not to provoke Russia, inverted commas, is definitely there. But this angle on big business is also interesting. Of course, it's a tragedy that we've gone from as long as it takes to as long as we can. And now we seem to be in the territory of as long as it doesn't upset the Kremlin. And that should definitely not be the guiding factor behind policy, nor, I would argue, should large companies be influencing foreign policy. But we know that for decades, this is likely to be the case. It is also speculated that the seizure of Russian central bank assets, of which many of the arguments made are on moral, legal grounds, which are shaky, to put it mildly. But actually, again, the speculation is that it's big business, those companies that are still operating in Russia or have assets in Russia that are the main voice in preventing the seizure of Russian central bank assets because they fear a like-for-like confiscation of their assets in Russia. Well, I can tell them right now, one, this is deeply immoral, two, their assets are going to be seized at some point anyway. We've got a story towards the end of this episode which talks about the creeping nationalization of private enterprise in Russia. So, again, we are potentially delaying something that could have a huge impact on Ukraine's ability to fight the war, and we are doing that for largely spurious reasons. Well, let's have a look at this Euromaidan Press article here about the influence of big oil on US foreign policy. And US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin echoed statements from White House and State Department officials criticizing Ukrainian attacks on Russian oil refineries, citing, of course, potential energy repercussions. Now, a lot of people who are experts in the oil industry have pointed out that that is a bit spurious because a lot of these oil products are being used domestically in Russia and are unlikely to have an influence on the price of global crude. The levels of output, however, do have a huge impact. That is the levels of output of OPEC countries, US, and so on. And therein, there may be some levers that the Biden administration could pull. We also see the instability in the Middle East and the acts of Houthis as being potentially a more significant impactor of global oil prices because they can directly affect export and shipping that crucially is relied upon for much of this global trade. So the US has not given or sold Ukraine anything with which it could strike tactical and operational targets in Russia. So these capabilities are very much ones that Ukrainians have developed for themselves, and it is their sovereign right to do so. But focusing on what is driving Lloyd Austin and other positions within the US administration, a Ukrainian energy expert, Mikhail Honchar, has analyzed the situation and identified several other factors. He suggests the real reason global energy prices are being impacted is not strikes against Russian facilities, but it is the inability of the US-led coalition to deal with Houthis in Yemen, whose attacks on oil tankers in the Red Sea have forced them to use longer and more expensive routes. Honchar also suggests that the change in Lloyd Austin's stance, who previously has been relatively hawkish with regards to Russia and supporting Ukraine, he says that this may be the result of pressure from external influences, for instance, through US oil giants ExxonMobil and Chevron. In 2022, these companies reported revenues of $235 billion and $413 billion, respectively, far surpassing the entirety of Ukraine's GDP, which currently amounts to around $160 billion. These corporations, he claims, maintain powerful lobbies within US administrations, regardless of who occupies the White House. And here we have another lever that, unfortunately, Russia can pull to potentially escalate prices, and this is oil from Kazakhstan, which is transported to global markets via the Caspian Pipeline Consortium. Now, this runs primarily through Russia and is operated by the Russian monopoly Transneft. This arrangement, he claims, allows Russia to control the flow of oil from American companies in Kazakhstan, potentially using it as a lever to influence US policy. Chevron's Tengiz oil and gas field in Kazakhstan was developed through Tengiz Chevron oil joint venture and is a significant source of revenue for the country. Chevron continues to expand production and has invested over $40 billion in a new phase of that oil and gas field. Previously, industry analysts warned that the CPC pipeline route and the Tengiz Chevron oil joint venture were vulnerable to potential Russian retaliation against West sanctions imposed in response to the invasion of Ukraine. Chevron claims not to be concerned by this, however. And this article contains a lot more detail for those who are interested in the weak points of global oil supply and areas where Russia can exert influence. This is definitely a sobering and interesting read. And Forbes digs in further detail, claiming Ukraine has developed 15 kinds of long-range strike drones and has used many of them in sorties against Russia's oil industry. At the moment, this is confined to the oil refining capacity, but we do have to ask ourselves, if Ukraine comes under further physical threat, and actually if that threat becomes existential to the very existence of the Ukrainian state, we have to ask what they wouldn't do. In fact, what you wouldn't do if faced with a similar circumstance. So widening the strikes against Russian oil industry is something that has to be considered as a potential next step in Ukraine's struggle to survive, let alone be victorious against its giant aggressive neighbor. So it could strike other infrastructure, for instance, transportation pipes, ports, the export of raw crude, which it hasn't yet included in its targets. All these must be considered by Ukraine in order for it to survive the onslaught from Russia. And the US administration needs to understand this. Escalation management will not work when Ukraine is faced with annihilation. Ukraine should, and I think would, do everything it needs to do in order to gain the upper hand. And oil seems to be the best lever that it can pull. Well, there's some great detail in this Forbes article about the different types of drones, the different development that's gone on to produce them, And it lists some of the strikes that have been used by different drone types based on their technical capacities. So this is an interesting one to read, and the link is in the description of this video. Now we turn to the Shadow Fleet. Again, it's something we have mentioned in interviews with Jerry Hendrix and others. We've mentioned it in other Silicon Bites, but here is a fascinating article by Vox talking about Russia's Shadow Fleet that is sneaking oil around the world. And it points out, and this is an incredibly important point that is rarely discussed, it's an ecological disaster waiting to happen. The world's next big maritime catastrophe could involve sanctions dodging Russian rust buckets that are not part of the global maritime insurance industry. The Shadow Fleet is of growing concern, not only because of the revenue that these oil shipments bring to Moscow, which fuels its more than 2-year-old war, but because of the nature of the ships themselves, writes Vox. They tend to be older. They may be less well maintained, and they're run by less experienced crews. And of course, they carry less or no insurance that they should do. Now, this was a comment by Erik Brøkhusen, head of the tanker research at Poten and Partners, an oil and gas consulting firm. But the Shadow Fleet has created a booming market for old tankers, including many that are over 20 years old. The average age of tankers departing Russia's Baltic Sea port of Kaliningrad is now close to 30 years old. That makes it more likely that ships have fallen into poor condition and makes them more prone to accidents. So not only are we risking a Russian victory, not only are we appeasing Russia by turning a blind eye and letting them get away with it, we are also enabling an incredible time bomb that could destroy the ecology of seas like the Baltic Sea or the Black Sea, which are precious marine environments. Action ought to be taken against this for a number of reasons, as the article points out. Why is it so important for Ukraine to potentially increase its strikes against Russian oil capacity? Well, at the moment, it seems that around 12 to 14% of Russia's capacity to create refined fuel oils has been hit. But Novogazeta has written an important article dated 14th of April that talks about the so-called stalemate in Ukraine and the fact that Russia is in no way ready to negotiate. Russia, the article writes, has a readiness to throw absolutely everything that it has at the war. This article, written by Dr. Christopher Morris of the University of Portsmouth, begins, "Not long ago, the situation in Ukraine could have been characterized as stalemate. Today, the situation of the defenders is worse, with Ukrainian positions heavily contested along long sections of the front line. Russian troops are advancing, and concern is building that they may be able to break through." Now, this kind of reporting needs to be tempered with some of the other stuff we see coming out about the Russian front lines. Yes, they're breaking through, but where there is intelligence of armored vehicles and tanks in use, we are seeing heavy use of the T-55. That's a tank produced shortly after the start of the Cold War. And this isn't just raw recruits who are driving these. Some of the most elite units of the Russian army have been seen in T-55s. That suggests a certain level of desperation. That suggests that stocks of more modern battle tanks and munitions are certainly low, if not exhausted, on the Russians' side. But as Dr. Christopher Morris points out, these advances are not game-changing yet. However, they do indicate that Russia can move forward, that it still intends to win the ground war, and it is backed by aircraft and guided bombs, glide bombs, which are having quite an impact on the front line. Russian troops can put pressure on Ukrainian forces who are overstretched, exhausted, and of course, we know are short on equipment. Now, both the glide bombs and Russia's ability to control the air at present, or its increased ability to control the air war, could, of course, experience a huge setback if Ukraine were to get F-16s. If they'd already received F-16s when they were promised, then Ukraine would likely not be in the position it finds itself today. But the article states, admittedly, what Russia has been able to accomplish so far this year doesn't feel much like winning. They've recaptured some important territory, though the price paid has been enormous. The capture of Avdiivka alone cost Russia thousands of troops and hundreds of vehicles. Stopping these advances from turning into breakthroughs is costly for Ukraine. Despite all of its losses, Russia still seems to be massing forces for further offensives. And of course, we hear rumors and speculation about the latest mass mobilization that will be kicked off, apparently, over the next couple of weeks and months. And the nature of the front line is changing too. The presence of drones is increasing. The lethality of artillery is increasing, with, of course, drone communications, and the drones are making any kind of rapid movement warfare all but impossible. Both sides are dug in. There are extensive networks of trenches and minefields around key locations. And as per the US advice to Ukraine when the summer offensive seemed to fail last year, Ukraine has started digging in to many key positions along the massive front line. But what is happening to change this scenario? Well, Volodymyr Zelensky has now signed into law a bill on the 2nd of April, which lowers the conscription age from 27 to 25, and Ukraine's parliament has just passed a bill to overhaul the country's system of mobilization. All the details are not yet out, are not entirely clear, but it does seem Ukraine is gearing up for a much more extensive mobilization. Now, that is not going to be hugely popular if there is a suspicion that Ukraine does not have the weapons it needs to allow those new troops to be trained properly and to do the job. So this is an absolutely critical time, with Russia clearly intent on taking more Ukrainian territory and Ukraine gearing up to meet that threat. The onus should be on Europe and the US now to give Ukraine the munitions it needs so those additional troops are not mobilized in vain. And it cannot have escaped people's attention that Iran has attacked Israel over the weekend, and in some ways, very much using the tactics that Russia has been using against Ukraine. Iran has learnt the lessons from Russian strikes against Ukraine to hit Israel, says the Kyiv Post in an article dated from this weekend. The composition of the ongoing Iranian attack on Israel is similar to the composition of Russian strikes that have repeatedly targeted Ukraine on a near daily basis. These Russian strikes have attempted to deliver the optimal package to penetrate Western air and missile defenses. It seems, however, that the Iranians, in copying these tactics, have not successfully broken through into Israeli cities or broken through the Iron Dome defensive system. Russia, however, has experimented with combinations of ballistic and cruise missiles alongside Iranian drones. Iran's use of drones and missiles show how Iran is learning from the Russians to develop increasingly dangerous and effective strike packages against Israel. Iran, as we've noted before, is also using the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea to refine Iranian drone tactics by testing US naval air defenses. Now, we will cover this topic in more detail as it unfolds. At this point, it is not exactly clear whether Iran attacking Israel is beneficial to Russia because it deflects from the Ukraine war, because it puts the focus on supporting Israel rather than the Ukraine. But if it provokes a massive retaliation against Iran, that could actually have a negative effect in galvanizing the West into action, in targeting the drone factories in Iran, and really taking seriously the disruption of the Houthis and the disruption of transport of munitions, components, equipment, and so on between Iran and Russia. Now, we will only be able to tell that course of action as it unfolds through the week and over the coming weeks and months. Now, Zelensky has roundly condemned the Iranian missile and drone attack on Israel. This is reported in the Kyiv Independent. President Volodymyr Zelensky on April the 14th condemned Iran's massive aerial attack on Israel, saying Ukraine is familiar with the horrors of similar attacks. And he's used this opportunity to call on allies to do more to prevent escalation in the Middle East. But also, he's been quite clear that this highlights that when the West has the will to defend one of its allies, then it can bring extreme force to bear. And this has left many Ukrainians asking the question, if Israel deserves this immediate response, then why doesn't Ukraine? The sound of Shahed drones is a tool of terror, said Zelensky. It is the same in the skies over the Middle East and Europe, he said in a statement on X. This sound must serve as a wake-up call to the free world, demonstrating that our unity and resoluteness can save lives and prevent the spread of worldwide terror. I'll put a link to the article and the full speech. I think his words are incredibly important. And Zelensky, I'm glad to see, is no longer pulling his punches. He's calling out double standards. He's demanding what Ukraine needs, and he's right to do so. He should not be embarrassed about that. He should not temper his words when faced with the lack of support from the US over the last 6 months. He should express the truth as he sees it and in the powerful, forceful way that he's entirely capable of doing. And this is very important, as we've said at the start of this episode, because of the situation on the Eastern Front. And here's an article where the words of the commander of the Ukrainian forces, Sirsky, are quoted from the Kyiv Independent. He says the situation on the Eastern Front has significantly deteriorated over the last few days amid an intensification of Russia's offensive efforts. The dire warning comes against the backdrop of a shortage of ammunition plaguing the Ukrainian military. That, of course, is exacerbated, as we know, by the impasse in Congress over US aid. Also, unseasonably warm and dry weather seems to have enabled Russia to increase its armored assaults in areas of Bakhmut, Lyman, and Pokrovsk. The general said that the tempo of the Russian offensive in the east has heightened since last month's presidential election, which saw Vladimir Putin winning another 6-year term in office. Of course, that election is widely thought to have been completely rigged. Ukraine is working to stabilize the situation and strengthen the most problematic defensive areas of the front line with electronic warfare and air defense. It's also reported that Ukraine has started to deploy extensive minefields, in that sense, mirroring the strategies that we see were deployed last year by the Russians. But the intensity of fighting comes at a cost. And this is certainly a disturbing article from the Kyiv Independent. It says that due to the intense fighting and lack of resources, it means that many wounded soldiers on the Ukrainian side are unfortunately left on their own. They're unable to be evacuated, or if they do get medical treatment, then it is on a limited sense at the front lines, and the evacuation of their troops may be happening too slowly to save lives. And this is the harrowing story of Mykhaila, who visited trenches in the Donetsk Oblast an hour after it was hit by Russian drones. The 40-year-old Ukrainian soldier immediately started going through bodies looking for signs of life. He knew that four soldiers had been taking shelter there, yet he saw only two bodies and no one else. When I got there, he said, those two were already cold. It was mid-February. The men's limbs were torn off. There's no time to linger around. The dugout positioned near the Russian-occupied Bakhmut in eastern Donetsk Oblast could easily become a target again, so he left. Later, he learned what had happened. Four soldiers were on their way back to the rear from the frontline positions from a shift change and took cover in the dugout. When Russian drones hit it, two were killed immediately, one was wounded, and one is considered missing. What happened next is typical for parts of the front line that suffer from the lack of combat medics and frontline evacuation. The wounded soldier got out of his dugout and walked to the nearest evacuation point, located a few hundred meters away, on his own. As positions as heavily shelled and close to Russian troops as this one, soldiers say that medical evacuation doesn't exist. "I know I am going to meet death there," Mikhailo says, who goes by the call sign Nimi. Evacuation is unfortunately impossible in the current conditions. Well, there are more stories, more first-hand eyewitness accounts in this story. Of course, we'll post a link in the description of the video. And Russia seems to have set itself a target to capture Chasiv Yar by Victory Day on May the 9th, Sirsky says in a follow-up to his address reported in the Kiev Independent. The Russian military leadership set a goal to capture the town of Chasiv Yar just west of the Russian-occupied Bakhmut, says Commander Sirsky, on April the 14th. On May the 9th, Russia celebrates Victory Day, a heavily militarized holiday marking the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Russian troops are concentrating their efforts to break through west of occupied Bakhmut, Sirsky said. He explained that they're trying to reach the Siversky-Donetsk Canal, an artificial waterway south of the river it's named after, and seize Chasiv Yar to advance further toward Kramatorsk agglomeration. The enemy's plans are being hampered by the heroic defense of our brigades, who've literally dug themselves into the ground, holding off the enemy's daily attacks, he said. This article contains more detail about those reported Russian plans and again provides some absolutely harrowing testimony about the effort, the heroic effort of Ukrainians to hold the Russians at bay. And as well as the gaps in enforcing oil sanctions, it seems there are huge gaps in enforcing other kind of exports that benefit Russia's war effort. This includes drone components and missile parts, which allow Russia to continue its murderous assault on Ukrainian cities, towns, and villages. Military aid for Ukraine is limited while Russia continues to have access to critical components needed to produce missiles and drones, says President Volodymyr Zelensky, as was reported in the Kyiv Independent on April the 14th. Each missile targeting Ukraine contains at least dozens of components, electronics, chips supplied by companies from other countries and imported through the territory of Russia's neighbors. All this must be stopped, and it can be stopped, including the tolerance of terror, the ability of terrorists to seek allies around the world, and Russian terror itself in all its manifestations, he said. Zelensky added that the fact that sanctions against Russia are still being circumvented and that Ukraine's been waiting for US military aid for months shows that the terrorists' confidence has been on the rise for months as well. "We cannot waste any more time," he said. I think everyone watching this channel would entirely agree with that sentiment. And meanwhile, while Russia throws everything it has economically, militarily, as well as resources at its war in Ukraine, it means that Russia is neglecting investment in the home front. It means that specialists and equipment that could deal with disasters in Russia itself are now no longer available and are no longer a priority. The Moscow Times reports that flooding in Russia's Orenburg region has been intense and the worst in decades. Russia declared a state of emergency in the Orenburg region as it grappled with the worst floods in decades, with further flooding expected in western Siberia's Kurgan and Tyumen regions. The Ural River overran its banks in the towns of Orsk over the weekend after torrential rain burst a nearby dam. That led to the city being submerged in water and has forced thousands from their homes. We've also started to see extraordinary outbursts of public anger, the kind of anger and confrontation of officials that we do not see in relation to the Ukraine war. But here we do start to see that boiling over. And it is fascinating to see Russian civilians actually vocalizing opposition to officials. Now, we have to remember these are local officials, and often it is the strategy of the Kremlin to pass down blame to governors and local officials as a way of deflecting criticism from its own management of the country and the economy. But it is absolutely certain that Russia's prosecution of the war in Ukraine has left it weakened to deal with such domestic catastrophes. And indeed, the entire Putin system of government, the vertical of power, has resulted in decades of underinvestment as well as corruption and nepotism, which means that when money is invested, it is often not effective. Emergency services warned that the combination of rain and snow melt amid unusually warm temperatures could cause more rivers to flood and overflow. And this is expected to peak on Wednesday of this week. Here are some of the dramatic photos that have been playing during this segment, showing the extraordinary scale of the devastation. And of course, many commentators have said that there is an element of karma in this. We would not wish ill to any civilians of any country, in fact, but there is an element of karma given that Russia is likely to have purposely destroyed the Kakhovka dams in Ukraine last year, causing similar scenes of devastation. In that instance, however, rescue workers were having to fight to get civilians under conditions of being shot at and shelled. So that is a substantial difference to what rescuers are facing in Russia. However, many of the specialists who would have dealt with that kind of flood and indeed equipment that may have been deployed, well, a lot of that has probably been turned to scrap on the battlefields of Ukraine. And here are a couple of stories that we're going to quickly mention before the end of the segment, but I think they are quite important because they show the direction of travel in Russia. This one is from the Moscow Times, and it talks about the Kremlin's creeping nationalizations. And in this instance, it has hit businesses in Chelyabinsk. Metals plants, agribusinesses, and food firms owned by Chelyabinsk's top businessmen and politicians have been subject to nationalization suits that have been brought in through hasty proceedings in Russian courts. The Kremlin's wartime campaign of forced nationalization has hit the mountainous Chelyabinsk region, a major industrial center, perhaps more than any other oblast. Since the February 2022 invasion of Ukraine, Russian prosecutors have targeted 55 enterprises comprising metals, chemicals, agribusiness, and even a major car dealership for compulsory state takeover, according to figures released on the RBC News website. But in recent weeks, metal plants and agribusiness food stores, as well, owned by top businessmen in the area, as well as politicians, have been subject to nationalization suits brought in through the courts. And what we are seeing is that assets are likely being transferred to regime loyalists and away from those who've perhaps been silent or muted in their support of Russia's military operations in Ukraine. The pretexts for wartime nationalization suits range from claims of unlawful privatization to enterprises coming under foreign control and alleged breaches of Russian anti-corruption legislation. Well, in reality, the Russian courts are a tool that can be entirely manipulated by power. These kind of lawsuits are likely to be entirely spurious, but in a society which essentially does not have any foundations of rule of law, and where it is often the will of the most powerful that prevails, this is hardly a surprise. And in that vertical structure, we know that the Kremlin is the ultimate power and ultimate arbiter of what may happen in courts, who may be prosecuted and under what pretext? It's highly likely we will see a lot more of these nationalizations as Russia seeks to scrape together more and more resources to throw into its pointless, destructive war in Ukraine. Here's a quick story from the Kyiv Independent that may be interesting to follow through as we get closer to the US presidential election. It has been reported that Trump apparently thought that Ukraine must be part of Russia when he was president. As president of the US, Donald Trump made it very clear that he believed Ukraine must be a part of Russia. His former advisor, Fiona Hill, wrote in an article for The Guardian dated on April 12th. This cites an excerpt from a book by the New York Times reporter, David Sanger. In early April, media reported, citing undisclosed sources, that Trump had privately said he could end Russia's war by pressuring Ukraine to cede Crimea and Donbass to Moscow, which, however, was denied by Trump's advisers. Trump has repeatedly said he could end Russia's war within 24 hours if elected president. But the important thing to ask, the important thing to ask any representative, anyone who is standing under a MAGA banner, anyone who supports the re-election of Trump over Biden, the important question to ask is how. How will he end the war without specifying the specific steps required to reach a peace deal between Kyiv and Moscow? Saying he can end it without saying how is disingenuous, and it needs to be challenged even by those people who support Trump's re-election. He really could not get his head around the idea that Ukraine was an independent state, quotes Fiona Hill. The book's author wrote that such a view of Trump regarding Ukraine coincided exactly with that of the Kremlin and with Vladimir Putin, who has repeatedly denied Ukraine's statehood and independence. And we have to note that Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has entirely rejected the idea of ceding the country's territories in exchange for peace. And lastly, here is another fascinating piece from the Kyiv Independent, and it is a poll of French youth which claims that almost half of them have stated they are willing to fight in Ukraine if it meant defending France. Over half of young French citizens would fight in Ukraine, according to a poll cited by Le Parisien, a French newspaper, on April the 12th. The Institute for Strategic Studies of the Military School and General Directorate for International Relations and Strategy surveyed 2,300 young people aged between 18 and 25 last summer. Of the respondents, 51% said yes, including 17% absolutely agreeing and 34% answering maybe yes. Young French citizens also favour deploying French troops to Ukraine more than the older generation. In the survey, 31% of youth thought positively about deploying French troops on the side of Ukraine, while only 17% of those aged more than 50 agreed. That is an extraordinary total, and it is also reflected in Macron's radical change of view and his much more vocal support of Ukraine and potentially far greater material support as well that we've been noticing in recent weeks. With Ukraine facing difficulties on the battlefield and hampered by delayed funding from the US, which we've repeatedly mentioned, some European countries are growing increasingly concerned that the war could spread. Estonia and the Czech Republic have also said that Europe should not dismiss the idea of deploying troops for non-combat tasks in Ukraine, and of course not to the front lines, but to the unoccupied parts of Ukrainian territory. This is an extraordinary poll, and I think we really need to dig into this further to see what the views of other populations throughout Europe are, especially in countries that are especially in countries like the UK that are extremely pro-Ukrainian. We have seen the position on many countries change radically from 2 years ago, from not supplying tanks to supplying tanks, not supplying long-range missile capabilities such as Scalp and Storm Shadow. We're now starting to see movement on F-16s. So what seemed impossible a number of months ago, a number of years ago, is now the reality. So who knows what may happen over the next couple of months? And as that threat increases in terms of Ukraine potentially ceding more territory to Russia, we may see further movement amongst European countries. And I sincerely hope we do, because a Ukrainian victory is a victory for Europe as well. A Ukrainian loss puts the security of Europe on an extremely dangerous and fragile footing.